cake like Japan's? The consensus answer among the dinner guests to that question was that the U.S. economy would probably have a prolonged Japan-like slump. Bernanke, however, surprising the table, said that neither scenario was a real possibility. "We've learned so much from the Great Depression and Japan that we won't have either," he said assuredly. "We've made a decision," Paulson announced to his team and advisors in a conference room at Treasury the last week of August, "about the fate of Fannie and Freddie. They can't survive. We have to fix this if we are going to fix the mortgage market." Upon his return to Washington from Beijing, Paulson had spent a day listening to presentations from Morgan Stanley and others and had decided that they had no choice but to take action, especially as he watched the shares of both companies continue to slide. To Paulson, unless he solved Fannie and Freddie, the entire economy would be in jeopardy. Morgan Stanley had spent the past 3 weeks working on what was internally called Project Foundation. Some 40 employees had been assigned to the task, working nights and weekends. "It's easier in jail," complained Jimmy Page, an associate. "At least you get 3 meals a day and conjugal visits." The firm had undertaken a loan-by-loan analysis of the portfolios of the two mortgage giants, shipping reams of mortgage data from Fannie and Freddie off to India, where some 1,300 employees in Morgan's analytics center went through the numbers on every single loan, nearly half the mortgages in the entire United States. The Morgan Stanley bankers had also conducted a series of phone calls with investors to get a better sense of the market's expectations. The outcome was, as Dan Simkowitz described it to the Treasury team, "The market cares what the Paulsons think, John Paulson and Hank Paulson. They want to know what John Paulson thinks is enough, and they want to know what Hank Paulson is going to do." John Paulson was the most successful hedge fund investor of the past 2 years, having shorted subprime before anyone else, making some $15 billion for his investors, and personally taking home more than $3.7 billion. The Morgan Stanley bankers estimated that the two mortgage companies would need some $50 billion in a cash infusion just to meet their capital requirement, which should be equal to 2.5% of their assets. Banks, at a minimum, had to have at least 4%. With the housing market deteriorating, it was clear that the GSE's thin capital cushion was in danger. Worse, Paulson could see signs that China and Russia could soon stop buying and perhaps begin selling Fannie and Freddie debt. Jamie Dimon had separately called him and encouraged him to take decisive action. Paulson led a discussion around the table at Treasury about whether it made sense to put Fannie and Freddie in Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, or whether conservatorship, in which the companies would still be publicly traded with the government as a trustee exercising control, was the better option. Ken Wilson was a bit anxious about pursuing what Paulson was describing as a hostile takeover without more professional guidance. "Hank, there is no fucking way we can pursue these kinds of alternatives without getting a first-rate law firm," Wilson told him. "Okay," Paulson agreed. "So what do you think?" "Let me call Ed Herlihy at Wachtell and see if he'll do it," Wilson said. "The idea of putting these guys in Chapter 11 is a joke. These are still privately owned entities with obligations to shareholders and bondholders. It's going to get ugly." Wilson had a compelling reason for having recommended Herlihy. He had been involved in some of the biggest takeover battles in corporate America. Earlier in the year, he had helped advise J.P. Morgan Chase in its acquisition of Bear Stearns. His firm, Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, was synonymous with corporate warfare. One of its founding partners, Martin Lipton, had devised among the most famous of anti-takeover defenses, the poison pill. If Treasury was planning a government-led hostile takeover, the first in history, then Herlihy was certainly the lawyer they wanted. They began their battle plans on the weekend of August 23rd. Herlihy and a team of Wachtell Lipton lawyers came to Washington on a half-dozen different Delta and U.S. Airways shuttles in order not to arouse suspicion. Paulson walked them through the game plan, assisted by Dan Jester, the lanky Texan who had joined Treasury less than a month earlier. The hope was that, like mega-mergers that are often completed over the course of a single 3-day weekend to protect against a leak impacting the stock market, they could take Fannie and Freddie over during the Labor Day holiday, which was the following weekend. The lawyers and the Treasury officials spent several hours debating possible tactics, relevant statutes, and the structures of each of the companies. Jester and Jeremiah Norton, another staffer at Treasury, outlined a plan to put capital into Fannie and Freddie, and an actual mechanism to take control of them via the purchase of preferred stock and warrants. But Paulson soon realized that the Labor Day target was going to be impossible. One of the lawyers had noticed that Fannie's and Freddie's regulator from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, James Lockhart, had written letters to both companies over the summer, saying that they were considered adequately capitalized. "You've got to be kidding me," Paulson replied when he heard about the letters. Treasury could face resistance from the GSE's supporters in Congress and from the companies themselves if the government were to reverse itself apparently arbitrarily. The companies' claims that they were well capitalized and the regulator's endorsement would both have to be challenged. "That's intangibles and all the stuff that I would call bullshit capital," Paulson complained. "We need to reconstruct the record," Jester announced about the Federal Housing Finance Agency letters. "Right, right," Herlihy chimed in. "We need new letters that are pretty bad, or at least accurate." The Federal Reserve was then asked to provide examiners, and they would spend the next 2 weeks going through the books, desperately trying to document the capital inadequacies at Fannie and Freddie. As the Treasury team went around the table, one issue kept getting raised about pushing forward with the takeover. What if the boards of the two companies resisted? "Look, trust me," Paulson said. "You don't believe me, but I know boards, and they're going to acquiesce. When we get done talking with them, they'll acquiesce." On the morning of Tuesday, August 26th, Paulson walked over to the White House and was escorted downstairs to the basement of the West Wing, where he was given a seat in the 5,000-square-foot Situation Room. At 9:30, President Bush was beamed onto one of the large screens from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, for a secured video conference with Paulson. After some brief pleasantries, Paulson laid out his plan to mount the equivalent of a financial invasion on Fannie and Freddie. Bush told him he could proceed with the preparations. As Labor Day weekend approached, the Treasury team and its advisors started to plot the actual details of the dual takeover. They knew they would have to move quickly, with military precision, and in secrecy before the GSEs could start rallying their supporters in Congress. They wrote scripts specifying exactly what they would tell the companies and their boards. They wanted to make certain that there could be no compromises, no delays. Internally, Treasury officials talked about offering Fannie and Freddie two doors. Door one, you cooperate. Door two, we're doing it anyway. On Thursday morning, August 28th, Bob Willemstad and AIG's head of strategy, Brian Schreiber, walked into J.P. Morgan's headquarters at 270 Park Avenue, and, escorted by a security guard, were taken by private elevator to the firm's executive floor, where they had an appointment with Jamie Dimon. Passing through the main glass doors into a wood-paneled reception area, Willemstad and Schreiber took in the newly renovated offices on the 48th floor. As the two men sat waiting, Willemstad knew his associate was silently irate. Schreiber had been working throughout August on various plans to raise capital and extend the company's credit lines to avoid facing a cash crunch if the market were to worsen. As part of his efforts, he had held a bake-off among a number of banks and had been unimpressed with J.P. Morgan's pitch. And he was still smarting from the firm's aggressive attitude when they raised capital for AIG in the spring. He had hoped to use Citigroup and Deutsche Bank, but Willemstad had insisted that they consider J.P. Morgan. The way things were playing out, if things really did get much worse, Willemstad figured he'd rather be dealing with an ally in Dimon, even if his colleague felt otherwise. The AIG executives were escorted to Dimon's office, which actually consists of an office with a desk, a sitting room, and a conference room. In the conference area, Dimon, Steve Black, the bank's president, and Cronenberg and Tim Main took their places around a wood table with a whiteboard behind them. After some small talk, Dimon thanked them for coming, and Main, who headed the bank's financial institutions group, launched into his pitch for why AIG should use J.P. Morgan. Main pointed out his group's number one ranking in the latest league underwriting tables and noted its work in helping CIT Group issue two equity offerings worth $1 billion. That's a dubious achievement to cite, Willemstad later commented to Schreiber, given that shares of CIT were trading below $10 in August 2008, when they were more than four times that a year ago. All in all, however, it was a fairly standard pitch from a Wall Street banker, the kind everyone in the room had heard dozens, if not hundreds, of times before. We're the best suited to help you. We have the most talent, the most resources. We understand your needs better than anyone else. But then, Main concluded with a not-so-subtle dig at AIG and his past experience with the company. He pointed out that J.P. Morgan had a lot to offer, but stressed that it was important that its clients recognize their own problems and shortcomings. Many in the room, including Diamond, were taken aback. "Forget Mr. Obnoxious," Diamond said, cutting Main off. But the damage had been done, and the AIG executives were clearly upset. Willemstad, finding the performance annoying, while Schreiber thought it was offensive. After a few minutes, they shrugged the comment off and resumed their talks with Diamond directly, as an embarrassed Main slumped in his chair. "Jamie, one of my concerns here is that there's a higher probability now that we're going to get downgraded," Willemstad explained. "The rating agencies promised me they would wait until the end of September, but then the Goldman report came out, and they got nervous," he said, referring to an analyst report issued by Goldman Sachs, raising questions about the firm. The report was so influential that Willemstad had received a call from Ken Wilson and Tony Ryan at Treasury to check up on the company. "Maybe you should just take the downgrade. It's not the end of the world," Diamond suggested. "No, this is not just a downgrade," Willemstad insisted. As the company had warned in an SEC filing several weeks earlier, a downgrade would be very expensive. If either Standard & Poor's or Moody's lowered its rating by one notch, AIG would be required to post $10.5 billion in additional collateral. If both agencies lowered their ratings, the damage would soar to $13.3 billion. As part of its contract to sell credit default swaps, AIG was required to maintain certain credit ratings or add new collateral to compensate, as insurance against its potential inability to pay out any claims on the swaps. AIG was now a AA-minus company, and it was facing a tab that was growing quickly. Its executives were estimating that the firm could soon be hit with demands for as much as $18 billion in additional collateral. Left unspoken was the fact that if AIG could not come up with the cash, bankruptcy was the only alternative. As Diamond saw it, this was a short-term liquidity problem. You have a lot of collateral, you know. You have a trillion-dollar balance sheet. You have plenty of securities, he told them. Yes, it could get much worse, but for now, it was just a temporary annoyance. We do, Willemstad agreed. But it's not that simple. Most of the collateral is in the regulated insurance companies. By mid-year, AIG had $78 billion more in assets than it had in liabilities. But most of those assets were held by its 71 state-regulated insurance subsidiaries, which could not be sold easily by the parent company. There is no federal regulation or supervision of the insurance business. Instead, state insurance commissioners and superintendents have substantial powers to regulate and restrict an insurer's asset sales. The responsibility of the state regulator at all times is to protect the policyholder. There was virtually no possibility that AIG would be able to raise cash quickly by selling some of these assets. Now Diamond finally understood the scope of the problem, as did everyone else in the room. Just as they were walking out, Diamond pulled Willemstad aside. "Listen, you don't have the luxury of time," he told him. "If it's not us, get someone else. But you need to get on this." The next day, Willemstad followed up on the meeting. "Jamie, this is only going to work if there is chemistry on both sides," Willemstad began. "With all due respect, I know you guys have a lot of confidence in Tim Main, but the reality is, you saw what I saw." Diamond knew exactly what Willemstad was about to say, and interrupted him with, "Steve Black will handle it." "Good," Willemstad replied. "You got to plan on packing your clothes and coming up," Ken Wilson told Herb Allison, the former Merrill Lynch and TIAA CREF executive, whom he located on a beach in the Virgin Islands on Thursday night, and let in on the big secret. The government planned to take over Fannie and Freddie that coming weekend, September 6th. It wasn't just a social call, however. Wilson had phoned Allison to hire him as the CEO of Fannie. After all, if they were going to take over the company, they wanted to install their own management. "Look, Ken," Allison told him, "I would like to. For reasons of public service, I'm interested in this job. I want to help you guys. And so you have to let me know what to do. I don't have any clothes. All I have is shorts and flip-flops." Wilson promised to buy him some clothes when he arrived in Washington. Paulson had decided to execute the takeover plan earlier in the week after a visit by Richard Syron, the chief executive of Freddie Mac. Syron, whom Paulson detested, told him that he had gone to Goldman Sachs headquarters to pitch potential investors, but several days of meetings proved to be in vain. No one was willing to make a significant investment in the company. Paulson's conversation with Dan Mudd, Fannie Mae's CEO, whom Paulson liked better, still wasn't inspiring. And so, on the night of Thursday, September 4th, Treasury began its battle plan. Like clockwork, the chief executives of Fannie and Freddie were instructed to attend meetings on Friday afternoon with Paulson and Bernanke at the offices of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Mudd's meeting would start at 3 o'clock, Syron's at 4 o'clock. They were each advised to bring their lead director, but told nothing else. Paulson figured that by the time any of this could leak, the markets would be closed, and he'd have 48 hours to execute his plan. That afternoon, dark rain clouds massed over the capital as Tropical Storm Hannah approached. In an upstairs conference room, Bernanke took a seat on one side of Robert Lockhart, while Paulson took his place on the other. At each meeting, Robert Lockhart began by telling the Fannie and Freddie executives and their lawyers that their companies faced such potentially great losses that they could not function and fulfill their mission. The FHFA, he said, reading from his prepared script, was acting rather than letting these conditions fester. The businesses would be put into conservatorship, he explained, and while they would still be private companies with their shares listed, control over them would be in the hands of the FHFA. Existing management would be replaced. There would be no golden parachutes. "I want to be fair, open, and honest," Paulson told them. "We'd like your cooperation. We want you to consent." But then he added, "We have the grounds to do this on an involuntary basis, and we will go that course if needed." Syron capitulated quickly, calling his board and breaking the bad news to them. Fannie's CEO, Daniel Mudd, wasn't so easy. He and his lawyers retreated to Sullivan and Cromwell's Washington office. The attorneys were furious, and Rodgen Cohen, usually an entirely self-possessed man, called Ken Wilson at Treasury directly and shouted, "Ken, what is going on here? This is bullshit." When Fannie executives began calling around for support from lawmakers on the Hill, they discovered that Paulson and Treasury had already secretly lobbied them on the wisdom of a takeover. For Democrats, the pitch was that the step had to be taken to keep the system of mortgage financing functioning, while for Republicans, the emphasis was on the systemic risk that Fannie and Freddie posed. Fannie's lawyers summoned all the members of the board to Washington for a meeting at the FHFA the following day. Treasury had made it clear that it wanted only board members present. Fannie could not bring its banking advisor, Goldman Sachs, to the gathering. At noon on Saturday, the lawyers, Beth Wilkinson, Rodgen Cohen, and Robert Jaffe of Kravath, Swain, and Moore, who were advising Fannie's board, accompanied the entire 13-member board, who crowded into the same small room at FHFA as had been used the day before when Treasury presented its terms. It would acquire $1 billion of new preferred senior shares in each company, which would give it 79.9% of the common shares of each. The government would contribute as much as $200 billion into both companies, if necessary. The terms were non-negotiable. The meeting ended quickly, and the Fannie directors left to deliberate. Wilkinson realized that she would have to cancel a birthday dinner she had planned for her husband, David Gregory of NBC News. Late that Saturday night, the board of Fannie Mae finally voted to give its assent. Paulson was awoken at 10:30 that night by a call from Barack Obama, the Democratic presidential candidate. Earlier that day, on a campaign stop in Indiana, Obama had said about the Fannie and Freddie situation that Any action we take must be focused not on the whims of lobbyists and special interests worried about their bonuses and hourly fees, but on whether it will strengthen our economy and help struggling homeowners. Obama and Paulson spoke for nearly an hour. After the takeover was announced on Sunday, there was palpable relief among the Treasury staffers who had been working on it for weeks. They had accomplished something that they were convinced would go a long way towards stabilizing the financial system. The markets would steady now that a major source of uncertainty had been removed. They had hit a home run. Paulson, however, still had one pressing concern: Lehman Brothers. Ken Wilson, with a free afternoon on his hands for the first time since he had started working for Paulson, left Treasury and walked to his apartment, and then to a pub in Georgetown to have dinner while watching a football game. That night, he checked his voicemail to find several messages from Dick Fuld. When he returned the call, Fuld told him how thrilled he was about the Fannie and Freddie news, hoping it would calm the markets. But he was distraught over the lack of deals available to him. The Korean situation seemed doomed. Bank of America was nowhere. Fuld said that the firm was planning to pursue a good bank, bad bank strategy, in which he hoped to spin off the firm's toxic real estate assets into a separate company. Stephen Schwartzman, the co-founder of Blackstone Group and a former Lehman banker, had just had a blunt conversation with Fuld. "Dick, this is like cancer. You've got to lop off the bad stuff. You need to get back to the old Lehman," he told him. Wilson, getting nervous that the spin-off plan wouldn't be enough, told Fuld, "You have to really think about doing what's right for the firm," trying politely to suggest that he needed to sell the firm without actually using the word. "What do you mean?" Fuld asked. "If your stock price continues to slide, something might come out of the woodwork here with a price that doesn't look that compelling, but you might have to take it to keep the organization intact." "What do you mean, low price?" "It could be low single digits." "No fucking way," Fuld said heatedly. "Bear Stearns got $10 a share. There's no fucking way I will sell this firm for less." Chapter 12. The news started crossing the tape late Monday night, and by 2 a.m., it had been picked up by every wire service in the world. The Korea Development Bank was no longer a bidder for Lehman. "Eyes on Lehman rescue as Korea lifeline drifts," the Reuters headline screamed. Jung Kwang-woo, chairman of the Financial Services Commission in Korea, had held a briefing with reporters in Seoul that night and all but proclaimed that the summer-long talks with Lehman were dead. Considering financial market conditions domestically and abroad, KDB should approach buying into Lehman at this point of time very carefully. Dick Fuld, alone in his office on Tuesday morning, sat staring at his computer screens, fixated in an unmitigated rage. To Fuld, the talks had long since ended. KDB had returned briefly with an offer of $6.40 a share, though Fuld didn't think they were serious. But to the public, which had heard about a rumored deal, the news reports would come as a shock. Shares of Lehman dropped precipitously from virtually the moment the stock market opened. The timing of the report was especially embarrassing to Fuld, in that it had come while Lehman was in the midst of holding its high-profile annual banking conference at the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, just two blocks away from his headquarters. A CNBC van was parked out front to cover the second day of the event. Bob Steele, now of Wachovia, and Larry Fink of BlackRock were set to present that morning. Bob Diamond of Barclays Capital had spoken at the conference the day before. Bart McDade walked into Fuld's office just after the markets opened. But before he could say anything, Fuld started shouting and pointing to the TV. "Here we go again," Fuld said. "Perception trumping reality once more." McDade politely turned his attention to the screen. CNBC's headline warned, "Time running out for Lehman." David Faber, the network's seasoned reporter, elaborated on that theme, pointing out, "They need to do an awful lot between now and next Friday, when the company reports earnings." But then he added, somewhat prophetically, "Can they actually report the losses that are anticipated on Friday and simply say, 'We're continuing to review strategic alternatives'? Perhaps they can. and perhaps they will have to, but there are certainly a lot of questions. As it happened, McDade had come to speak to Fold about precisely the subject that Faber had raised. McDade told Fold he thought they should pre-announce earnings before the scheduled earnings call next Thursday, maybe as early as the next day. "We have to settle things down," he told Fold. Fold, nodding in agreement, said, "We've got to act fast so this financial tsunami doesn't wash us away." McDade's overture to Fold was, at least in part, kabuki theater, for at this juncture, asking Fold's permission was simply a courtesy. McDade had already told Ian Lowett, Lehman's CFO, to get the numbers ready. He was also thinking of announcing the SpinCo plan, the good bank, bad bank plan, at the same time. Although McDade didn't require Fold's blessing to release the numbers, he and his cohorts had already stripped Fold of any real authority. He did need Fold's cooperation in leading the earnings call. For better or worse, he was still the public face of the firm, and his presence would be a key factor in helping to calm the markets. Given the complexities of their current situation, however, McDade was worried about Fold's emotional state. "I don't know if he can do it. He's under an enormous amount of stress," McDade told Gelband before he went to see Fold. From a public relations point of view, however, they had few alternatives, and McDade knew Fold would want to lead the earnings call. Fold wouldn't have it any other way. Hank Paulson looked dispirited Tuesday morning as he walked into the main conference room across from his office in the Treasury building, his team of advisors in tow: Tony Ryan, Jeremiah Norton, Jim Wilkinson, Jeb Mason, and Bob Hoyt. Their 10 a.m. meeting with Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase's operating committee had been set up weeks earlier as part of a series of all-day meetings the firm had scheduled to establish better relations with the government. That strategy had been devised by Rick Lazio, a former Republican representative from New York, whom Dimon had hired as Executive Vice President of Global Government Relations and Public Policy. Internally, J.P. Morgan's operating committee trips to Washington were jokingly referred to as OCDC. With the financial system teetering, Dimon knew that there would be calls for tighter federal regulation of Wall Street, and wanted to make certain that he had shaken all the right hands well in advance. "Thanks for coming down here," Paulson said somewhat sheepishly as he opened up the meeting. He was, in fact, still preoccupied with reaction to the takeover of Fannie and Freddie just 48 hours earlier. He believed that he had made exactly the right moves in orchestrating the affair, but investors hadn't seemed to agree. Far from stabilizing them, as he thought they might, the markets seemed to be on the verge of tanking again. Perhaps most grating of all was the reaction from Congress. He was particularly upset with Senator Dodd, whom he had personally briefed on Sunday, soon after the announcement. Dodd, he thought, had tacitly signaled his support, but the following day had publicly mocked him, quipping that his request for temporary powers, which Paulson had clearly indicated that he didn't intend to utilize, was merely a big ruse. "All he wanted was the bazooka. He didn't want to use it," Dodd wryly observed to reporters in a conference call on Monday. "We certainly accepted him at his word that that was all that was going to be necessary," Dodd said. "Fool me once, your fault. Fool me twice, my fault." And then Dodd openly raised the question that until then had only been whispered around Washington. "Is this action going to produce the desired results, or are there other actions being contemplated?" Senator Jim Bunning, who had sparred with Paulson over the summer, going as far as to brand him a socialist, was even more pointed. "Secretary Paulson knew more than he was telling us during his appearance before the Banking Committee. He knew that Fannie and Freddie were in an irreversible state of damage. He knew all along he was going to have to use this authority despite what he was telling Congress and the American people at the time." Paulson had allotted less than an hour to the J.P. Morgan meeting, even though he knew how important it was to Dimon. "I've been trying to encourage opening up the lines of communication between Wall Street and Capitol Hill," he now told the bankers, explaining that when he ran Goldman, he hadn't appreciated how important it was to establish the right relationships in Washington. Trying to get things done here ain't as easy as it seems, he said, his audience laughing at the clear reference to the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie. He asked Diamond what he thought of the move. Diamond, who had encouraged Paulson to pursue the conservatorship, responded positively, but diplomatically. It was the right thing to do. We could see just how big the problem was becoming over the weekend, and added that it had become clear that certain Fannie and Freddie bonds wouldn't roll on Monday. Diamond tactfully avoided mentioning the fact that the stock market didn't seem to be steadying. If you guys believe that, share it, Paulson said, before they got up to leave. I could use the help. No one around here wants to listen to my analysis. After that singular plea for help from the Treasury Secretary, J.P. Morgan's top executives splintered into smaller groups to make several obligatory courtesy drop-bys on the Hill to their federal overseers. Charlie Scharf, head of the firm's consumer business, and Michael Cavanaugh, its new CFO, went to see Sheila Bair, head of the FDIC. Steve Black paid a visit to James Lockhart. And later in the day, there was a meeting scheduled with Barney Frank for several members of the team. But the most important of the visits was Diamond's, with the Federal Reserve's Ben Bernanke. Diamond brought Barry Zubrow, the firm's chief risk officer, along with him. Zubrow, a relative newcomer to J.P. Morgan, was quickly becoming one of its key executives. A former banker at Goldman Sachs, where he had worked for more than 25 years, he was a close friend of John Corzine, the deposed Goldman boss who had gone on to become governor of New Jersey. If anyone at J.P. Morgan understood the risks in the market as well as Diamond, it was Zubrow. As Diamond and Zubrow entered the Federal Reserve's Eccles building on Constitution Avenue, Zubrow sneaked a quick look at his BlackBerry before passing through the security X-ray machine. He was alarmed at what he saw. Lehman's stock had plunged 38%, dipping to about $8.50 a share. In Lower Manhattan's financial district, Robert Willemstad, AIG's CEO, sat on the 13th floor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, waiting to meet with Tim Geithner. With the markets in turmoil, he had returned to see Geithner to press him again to consider making the discount window available to his company. While Geithner may have spurned his abstract request last month, this time Willemstad had come with a more detailed proposal to turn AIG into the equivalent of a primary dealer, like Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, or Lehman Brothers. It's going to be a few minutes. He's on the phone, Geithner's assistant told him. No problem, I have time, Willemstad replied. 5 minutes passed, then 10. Willemstad looked at his watch, trying to keep from getting annoyed. The meeting had been scheduled to start at 11:15. After about 15 minutes, one of Geithner's staffers, clearly embarrassed, came to speak with him. I don't want to hide the ball on you, he said. He's on the phone with Mr. Fuld, he revealed with a knowing smile, as if to indicate that Willemstad might be waiting a while longer. He's up to his eyeballs in Lehman. Finally, a half hour later, Geithner appeared and greeted Willemstad. Geithner was clearly overwhelmed, his eyes darting around his office as he nervously twisted a pen between his fingers. He had also just flown back from an international banking conference in Basel, Switzerland. After some pleasantries, Willemstad explained the purpose of his request for this meeting. He wanted to change, no, very much needed to have, AIG's role in the finance sector codified. He said that he wanted AIG to be anointed a primary dealer, which would give it access to the emergency provision enacted after Bear Stearns' sale, and thus enable it to tap the same extremely low rates for loans available only to the government and other primary dealers. Geithner stared poker-faced at Willemstad and asked why AIG FP deserved access to the Fed window, which, as Willemstad was well aware, was reserved for only the neediest of financial institutions, of which there were now far more than usual. Willemstad made his case again, this time with a litany of figures to back up his argument. AIG was as important to the financial system as any other primary dealer. With $89 billion in assets, it was actually larger than some of those dealers, and should therefore be granted the same kind of license. And he mentioned that AIG FP owned $188 billion worth of government bonds. But most of all, he told Geithner, AIG had sold what was known as CDS protection, essentially unregulated insurance for investors, to all of the major Wall Street firms. Since I've been here, we've never issued any new primary dealer licenses, and I'm not even sure what the process is, Geithner said. Let me talk to my guys and find out. Before Willemstad turned to leave, however, Geithner posed the question that really concerned him, the one that had been occupying his thoughts all morning. Is this a critical or emergency situation? Willemstad, fortunately, had been prepared to address this very topic. In meetings with AIG's lawyers and advisors, including Rajan Cohen at Sullivan & Cromwell and Anthony M. Santomero, the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, he had been guided on how to field the question with the advice, tread carefully. If he acknowledged that AIG had a true liquidity crisis, Geithner would almost certainly reject its petition to become a primary dealer, denying the company access to the low-priced funds it so badly needed. Well, you know, let me just say that it would be very beneficial to AIG, Willemstad carefully replied. He left Geithner with two documents. One was a fact sheet that listed all the attributes of AIG FP and argued why it should be given the status of a primary dealer. The other, a bombshell that Willemstad was confident would draw Geithner's attention, was a report on AIG's counterparty exposure around the world, which included $2.7 trillion of notional derivative exposures with 12,000 individual contracts. About halfway down the page, in bold, was the detail that Willemstad hoped would strike Geithner as startling. $1 trillion of exposures concentrated with 12 major financial institutions. You didn't have to be a Harvard MBA to instantly comprehend the significance of that figure. If AIG went under, it could take the entire financial system along with it. Geithner, his mind still consumed with Lehman, glanced at the document cursorily and then put it away. At Treasury, Dan Jester, Paulson's special assistant, had just returned to his office when his assistant announced something surprising. David Vinier, Goldman Sachs' chief financial officer, was on the telephone. Any call from Goldman would mean an awkward conversation for Jester, given that he used to work there. Unlike Paulson, Jester hadn't been required to sell all his Goldman Sachs stock when he took the job in Washington. And, unlike Paulson, who had to run the congressional gauntlet before joining Treasury, Jester, as a special assistant to the secretary, didn't require that official confirmation. Although Vinier had been a longtime friend and colleague from their days together at Goldman, he surely wanted to talk business. With the markets going wild, it was no time for social calls. After a short pause, Jester picked up the phone, and Vinier, after quickly greeting him, got right to the point. Could we be helpful on Lehman? While the question itself was carefully phrased, Vinier's timing was curious. Jester had just learned from Geithner that Lehman was likely to pre-announce a $3.9 billion loss on Wednesday. Fult had given the government a private heads-up, and less than an hour later, here was Goldman sniffing around. Anxious about running afoul of the rules, Jester stepped gingerly around the issue. But he did learn just enough to determine that Vinier was serious about its offer of assistance. Vinier told him that Goldman would be interested in buying some of Lehman's most toxic assets. Of course, it was clear that Goldman would only do so if it could buy the assets on the cheap. Vinier asked if Treasury could be helpful in arranging an entree. As soon as they hung up the phone, Jester reported the call to Robert Hoyt, Treasury's general counsel. With all the conspiracy theories circulating about Goldman and the government, any leaks about the call could be explosive. He needed to cover his ass. Now it was time to tell Paulson. At the Lehman Tower, Alex Kirk sprinted down the hall to McDade's office. Something strange is going on, he said, catching his breath. I just got off the phone with Pete Brieger. Brieger, the president of Fortress Partners, a giant hedge fund and private equity firm, was well wired into the rumor mill, a carryover from his days as a Goldman Sachs partner. He was calling, Kirk recounted, with what sounded like an ominous proposal. I know you're really loyal to Bart and to Lehman Brothers, and I would never make this call in any other circumstance, Brieger had told Kirk. But if you happen to be taken over this weekend by another financial institution, and you're not sure whether you want to go work at that financial institution, as opposed to Lehman Brothers, I really want you to come talk to me." Kirk, taken aback, managed to reply, "I'm flattered," his mind racing all the while. "I hope that actually doesn't happen," he continued. "I didn't even think you liked me." "I was talking to Wes about you the other day," Brieger said, referring to Wesley R. Edens, Fortress's CEO. "And I said, you know, not that I don't like you, but I was saying to Wes, I would much rather have partners that are really, really smart motherfuckers than guys that I like." Kirk laughed as he related the conversation to McDade, repeating the punchline twice. But it wasn't Brieger's backhanded compliment that was the odd part. It was his timing, which could hardly have been coincidental. Kirk was convinced that it was the result of a leak. "Why the hell is he calling me now?" Kirk asked McDade, throwing his hands in the air. Lehman wasn't in merger talks with anyone, at least not yet. Then, after McDade stared at him without answering, Kirk answered his own question. "I guarantee they know something that we don't." Jamie Dimon and Barry Zubrow sat in the anteroom of the Federal Reserve, waiting for Chairman Bernanke and his colleagues to appear. Their meeting was scheduled to run from 11:15 a.m. to 11:45 a.m., which meant that the two J.P. Morgan officers would have to speak quickly in order to tell the Keeper of the Secrets of the Temple everything they had planned to in the half-hour they had been allotted. Overlooking Constitution Avenue, the anteroom, despite its name, is a capacious space with 30-foot-high ceilings standing just off the boardroom, where the nation's main fiscal policies are hammered out, and steps from Bernanke's office. Looking around as he sat waiting, Dimon studied the portraits of all the former Fed chairmen, including Mariner S. Eccles, who was appointed the first chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System in 1934, when he noticed the conspicuous omission of Alan Greenspan among them. "Maybe that's appropriate," he joked, given what had been transpiring in the economy. Greenspan's portrait had, in fact, not yet been completed. Bernanke finally arrived and took his seat. He, too, had just been privately briefed that Lehman might pre-announce a staggering loss the following day, but had decided that he would keep that news to himself during his meeting with the J.P. Morgan executives. Dimon informed Bernanke that they had just come from a visit with Paulson at Treasury, and the conversation turned to the blowback he had been facing for orchestrating the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac takeover. "The negative publicity is really getting to him," Bernanke acknowledged of Paulson, who had spoken to him yesterday morning and gotten an earful about the press coverage. Dimon then launched into his semi-prepared remarks, glancing down occasionally at a paper on which he had scribbled some notes during the car ride over. "There's a broad lack of confidence out there," he said. "We're hearing it from our clients, our customers. We're seeing it in our prime brokerage." He pointed out that despite the fact that the turmoil was, temporarily and perversely, helping J.P. Morgan's business, since customers trusted it as one of the most solid banks, it was bad for everyone else and ultimately would be bad for his firm, too. This, of course, was hardly news to Bernanke, who sat politely nodding in his best professorial manner. Dimon then told the chairman, who had been joined by late-arriving Kevin Warsh, one of the Fed governors, that he was particularly worried about Lehman Brothers. He praised the decision to nationalize Fannie and Freddie, but noted the move had not helped calm the markets. "There's confusion about the role government will play going forward," he said, looking for the answer to the question on everyone's mind. Would the Fed back additional bailouts? Bernanke, however, wasn't prepared to show his hand, and as the meeting came to an end, would say only, "We're working on a number of initiatives. We're just trying to stay ahead of this thing." At Lehman, the air on the 31st floor seemed to only grow thicker as the day advanced. To some of his colleagues, Fold looked as if he were having trouble breathing. He had been debating all weekend about whether to call Bank of America, and Treasury's Ken Wilson had phoned him at least 3 times that morning to press that case. "You gotta make the call," Wilson instructed him. Wilson knew Bank of America well. During his stint at Goldman, he had been its banker for more than a decade. "It's a good strategic fit," Wilson urged. What Wilson hadn't told Fold was that he had already worked over Greg Curl of Bank of America to tee up the phone call, During an earlier conversation, Wilson had informed Fold that the only way a deal was going to take place was if he was willing to take Price off the table as a bargaining point. That was an indirect way of warning Fold that he didn't have much negotiating power or time. Rajan Cohen, who has a bad back, was standing at the computer in his corner office on the 30th floor of Sullivan & Cromwell's offices overlooking the New York Harbor when the phone rang. It was Dick Fuld, giving him the instructions to call Bank of America's Curl. Cohen scribbled out a script for himself as Fuld was speaking. The stakes on this one were too high to do a presentation off the top of his head. "Got it. I'll call you back after I've talked to him." Cohen studied his script one final time and got Curl on the line. "Look," he said amiably, "the world has moved a lot. We'd like to re-engage." "Okay," Curl said slowly, making it clear that while he agreed to listen to Cohen's pitch on behalf of his client, he remained wary. "We have two priorities, preserving Lehman's brand and reputation and doing well by the Lehman people," Cohen said. Then, checking the next sentence in the script, he paused for effect. "You will notice price is not a priority," he said, "but there is, of course, a price at which we could not do a transaction." "We could be interested," Curl replied cautiously. "Let me talk to the boss and call you back." "Greg, we'd be looking to do something quickly," Cohen told him. "Got it." Diamond and Zubrow hopped out of their black town car in front of 601 Pennsylvania Avenue, a six-story modern limestone building northwest of the White House that serves as J.P. Morgan's Washington headquarters. It was here that all of the government relations people worked, so a constant stream of Gucci-clad lobbyists was a familiar sight. By the time Diamond and Zubrow arrived, most members of the operating committee had already finished their morning meetings and were eating lunch in a conference room on the second floor. Sandwiches and sodas were being passed around as Kavanaugh was recounting how his conversation with Sheila Bair had gone, and Black was regaling the group with anecdotes from his encounter with James Lockhart. As the conversation inevitably turned to Lehman and its falling stock price, Diamond told the group about their discussion with Bernanke. "I think he gets it," Diamond said. But when a banker asked if the Fed was likely to bail out Lehman, Diamond's reply was unequivocal: "Not going to happen." Black had long been bearish on Lehman. At an internal leadership forum at J.P. Morgan in January 2007, he had predicted, "Dick Fuld will end up selling that company when he has to sell, instead of when he should have sold it." Reminding the group of his earlier prognostication, he announced, "I told you they would be fucked." The mood grew more somber, however, as they all realized what an upheaval of that order would mean to them. If Lehman went down, and the government elected not to intervene, J.P. Morgan itself could suffer colossal losses. Zubrow informed the group that John Hogan, chief risk officer for J.P. Morgan's investment bank, had sought more than $5 billion in collateral from Lehman the week before, and again during the weekend, but had received nothing as of yet. Zubrow had also been to see Lehman's CFO, Ian Lowitt, and put him on notice that J.P. Morgan was worried about them. Black suggested that they call Fuld and demand that he send the collateral immediately. Just as important, the group decided that they should probably broaden the collateral agreement so that they'd be able to ask for even more money if other parts of Lehman's business were to falter. Everyone agreed that this was the best course of action, so Black and Zubrow slowly rose from their seats and left the conference room. Their faces told the story. It was not going to be a pleasant conversation. Black dialed Fuld on the speakerphone, and when the connection was made immediately, explained their plight. "We got, you know, $6 to $10 billion worth of intraday exposure to you, and we don't have enough collateral," Black said. He reminded him that J.P. Morgan had asked for $5 billion the week before. "We understand that that's a tough ask for you guys," he continued. "So let's spend some time on how we might solve our issue without creating a major issue for you." In the back of Black's mind, he knew he was being far too generous. He could easily have said, "If you don't, we'll shut you down tomorrow morning," which we have every right to do. Initially, it seemed as if Fuld had understood the veiled threat. Let me get my guys and we'll take a look at it, he said resignedly. Fuld proceeded to conference Lowett into the call and calmly explained the situation to him. The four men discussed a handful of options that would enable Lehman to provide the collateral. Perhaps Lehman could move all its cash over to J.P. Morgan and just leave it on deposit, so we wouldn't count against the firm's capital. Fuld tried to turn the call around, using it as an opportunity to ask Black if J.P. Morgan might be willing to offer Lehman some amount of cash, perhaps in the form of a loan that could be converted into Lehman stock. After all, Diamond had always told Fuld to call if he needed anything. "We're getting ready to pre-announce tomorrow," Fuld told Black. "Maybe we need to hold that up for a day if you guys seriously think Jamie would consider doing a convert and taking a piece of us." To the J.P. Morgan bankers, it was a ludicrous suggestion, like someone's asking the repo man if he had any spare change. Black looked at Zubro as if to say, "Fuld has lost it," and replied carefully, "I don't have any ideas, any brilliant ideas off the top of my head, but if you're telling me you're at the point where you would consider that you're at the point where it's really getting difficult, then let us still talk and come back and see if there's anything we can do." 5 minutes later, after a quick and sober discussion with his colleagues, Black was back on the phone with Fuld. "Dick, there's nothing we can do, and frankly, there's nothing anybody's going to do other than what might be in their own self-interest," Black explained. "I'm sorry to say this, but my suggestion is to call the Fed and see if they might try and put together a long-term capital-type proposal and herd all the cats into one room." There was a pause at the other end of the line, and then Fuld said icily, "That would be terrible for our shareholders." Black could hardly keep from laughing. "No one is going to give a shit about your shareholders," he replied. Stilling his frustration, Fuld tried to re-engage Black. "I just talked to Vikram," he announced. "Citi is sending a bunch of guys over to meet with our capital markets guys, and some of our management team to see if there is some type of a capital market solution that we could announce at the same time that we're pronouncing earnings." "Citi? Was Fuld joking?" "Okay," Black said guardedly. "We can send over some of our guys." Black immediately called Doug Bronstein, head of J.P. Morgan's investment banking practice. "I'd like you to go and John Hogan to go," he told him after explaining the situation. "I have no idea what they want. The fact that Citi has an idea probably means it doesn't work," he said with a chuckle. "But see what is up, and see what they're talking about." Hank Paulson had his eyes fixed on his Bloomberg terminal as he watched Lehman's share price carefully. It was 2:05 p.m., and the stock was down 36% to $9, its lowest level since 1998. He had just gotten off the phone with Fuld, who had called with an update on his approach to Bank of America. Paulson was pleased to hear Fuld was now taking this seriously, but afraid it was all too late. On Paulson's television that moment, tuned to CNBC, the speculation among the network's commentators was illuminating. "The stock is coming down at the rate it's coming down because a number of people believe strongly that the company is headed for bankruptcy," explained Dick Beauvais, a veteran banking analyst at Ladenburg Thalmann. "I think that that belief is what is driving the short selling." Aaron Burnett, the anchor of Street Signs, countered, "But if people are still using the company as a counterparty, trusting the company, isn't that a significant statement?" "The key thing you have to understand is it's not in anyone's interest for Lehman to fail," replied Beauvais, who, oddly enough, had a buy on the stock and a $20 price target. "It's not in the interest of its competitors, Goldman Sachs, Morgan, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, because if Lehman were to fail, then the pressure moves to Merrill Lynch, and then it moves to who knows who else. It's also, you know, not in the interest of the U.S. government for Lehman to fail," Beauvais stressed again. "You have to believe, although I can't tell you this is true, that Lehman has been talking to the Federal Reserve of New York, to Ben Bernanke, probably to Hank Paulson, because they don't want this company to fail." How true. Paulson picked up the phone to call Geithner to discuss what other options they might pursue. By the time the closing bell rang at the New York Stock Exchange, Lehman's shares had taken a brutal beating, ending the day at $7.79, having fallen 45%. McDade's secretary could hardly keep up with the calls. McDade himself had to help his new CFO, Ian Lowitt, prepare the numbers for the following day's earnings call. They'd officially decided they had to pre-announce something, anything really, as investors needed to hear from them. McDade also had to brief Larry Wieseneck and Brad Whitman, whom he had designated to meet with J.P. Morgan and Citigroup executives at Simpson Thacker's Midtown offices later that day. They would ask for one or both banks to extend a credit line, or perhaps to consider helping them raise capital. Finally, perhaps the trickiest task of all, he had to figure out how the firm would position its good bank, bad bank plan to investors. The reason that was such a challenging proposition was that nobody could or would put a price on the firm's abundance of toxic assets. If all that weren't enough to deal with, McDade had just had a baffling conversation with Fuld, who informed him that Paulson had called him directly to suggest that the firm open up its books to Goldman Sachs. The way Fuld described it, Goldman was effectively advising Treasury. Paulson was also demanding a thorough review of Lehman's confidential numbers, courtesy of Goldman Sachs. McDade, though never much of a Goldman conspiracy theorist, found Fuld's report discomfiting, but moments later was on the phone with Harvey Schwartz, Goldman's head of capital markets. "I'm following up on Hank's request," he began. After another perplexing conversation, McDade walked down the hall and told Alex Kirk to immediately call Schwartz at Goldman, instructing him to set up a meeting and get them to sign a confidentiality agreement. "This is coming directly from Paulson," he explained. At 4:30 p.m., Paulson asked Crystal West, his assistant, to get Ken Lewis on the phone. Ken Wilson had just briefed Paulson on his most recent call with Fuld, his seventh of the day, about Bank of America again. Now Wilson told Paulson that all he needed to do was to make the case directly to its CEO. Paulson and Lewis did not know each other well, and the only real time they had spent together was a lunch in Charlotte several years back, when Paulson was still at Goldman. Ken Wilson had brought Paulson down to meet Lewis then to demonstrate Goldman's loyalty to their acquisitive client. "I've got Lewis on the line," West finally called out to Paulson, who picked up the receiver. "Ken," he began gravely, "I'm calling about Lehman Brothers," and after pausing said, "I'd like you to take another look at it." The receiver was silent for a few seconds. Lewis agreed to consider it, but added, "I don't know how much it will do for us strategically." He made it clear, however, that the price would have to be right. "If there's a good financial deal there, I could see doing it." Lewis's biggest concern about a potential deal, as he told Paulson, was Fuld, who Lewis worried would be unrealistic about his asking price. He recounted to Paulson how badly their meeting had gone back in July. "This is out of Dick's hands," Paulson assured him. It was a powerful statement that could be interpreted only one way. "You can negotiate directly with me." By 7:30 p.m., the conference room on the 30th floor of Simpson Thacker was packed with executives from J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, who were milling about impatiently. "This is going to be a waste of 2 hours of our time," John Hogan of J.P. Morgan whispered to his colleague, Doug Braunstein, who just smiled wryly. Larry Wieseneck greeted Gary Shedlin, co-head of Global Financial Institutions M&A of Citigroup, and one of his closest friends and regular golf partners at Crestmont, their club in New Jersey, then assessed the crowd. Realizing that he wasn't even certain who everyone was, he passed around a piece of paper, asking them all to sign in. If he was going to share confidential information with them, he wanted to know precisely with whom he'd be dealing. Wieseneck was particularly worried about the imbalance of people from J.P. Morgan's risk department compared to the deal-making bankers he had expected would be coming to help them think through their options. "These are all risk guys," he told his colleague Brad Whitman, as the two chatted in the corner, plotting strategy. This was supposed to be a meeting on how to save Lehman, he thought, not a due diligence session for J.P. Morgan to figure out the extent of its exposure if Lehman failed. Apologizing for the delay, Wieseneck announced to the room that they were waiting for Skip McGee, Lehman's head of investment banking, to arrive. We've got a lot of people here. Bronstein, who had brought his whole team along, complained. We can't wait here all night. As tension in the room continued to rise, Whitman finally received an email from McGee, who told him to go ahead and begin, as it was unlikely that he would be able to make it at all. After calling the group to order, Wiesenick walked it through Lehman's plan to spin off its real estate assets as a bad bank. Everyone agreed the plan was a good one, but there was general concern.